Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Focus Group Podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and this week we're looking forward into where the newest swingy type of swing voters are taking us, and I'm not sure you're going to like it. Last week with Mark Caputo, I talked about what the most recent Trump voters found appealing about him and his team. And when I say most recent, really what I'm talking about are people who've sort of come around to this guy in his 8th year of political existence. So this week, we're going to take a deeper dive into the relationships between these voters, their podcasts, meaning their podcast consumption, and their politics. And we're going to get their take on some recent news events and what those takes say about how they look at the world. Speaking of podcasts, my guest today is one of the top 10 podcasters on the news chart. Today, Tim Miller, host of the Daily Bulwark podcast. Tim, thanks for coming on, buddy.
Woof. Was this a punishment? Did I do something to you in the last month? Is there some inner office kind of tension I don't know about?
There is.
Making me listen to these focus groups was torture.
Well, it's because I need to make sure that you and JVL know that I love you equally. And therefore, JVL got himself on the show last week to do the other half that Ested and I didn't get to. The show that you said should be renamed And Another Thing.
And Another Thing with Sarah Longwell and Ested Hearn.
So JVL, he did the second half of that with all the sound we hadn't gotten to. So now you. You were also here, though, because...
I'm a bro.
No, you're a podcaster. I mean, we're all podcasters, but you do have, you know, a big, important podcast. You're a content man now. Right. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but I think there's a lot of people calling this sort of the podcast election. And we've talked a lot about this on our other shows, The Next Level. JVL and I talk about it on The Secret Pod. But the fact that the Trump team was willing to basically have an everything, everywhere, all at once media strategy, which included just constantly sitting down with non-traditional media, especially podcasts, was, I think, in retrospect, a big part of why their media strategy was ultimately better than Kamala Harris's and certainly Joe Biden's. And so we wanted to talk to voters about their podcast consumption and like who they listen to. And so we went and got ourselves a bunch of Joe Rogan listeners. I don't know if you knew that when you watched this. Did you know that was the screen?
I did. Okay. Well, I did because I like 12 minutes in and I messaged producer Connor and I was like, who are these people? Like, what am I watching? And he's like, oh, Biden to Trump Rogan listeners or first time Trump voting Rogan listeners. I was like, got it. That makes sense now, actually. It all came into focus, so to speak.
Well, look, when we think about the fact that the Democrats did uniquely less well with basically every demographic group except kind of our people, the college-educated suburban voters that Dems are hanging on to, everybody else they did worse with. And that includes younger people. And we have known for a long time doing the focus groups how much people's media diets are changing and how that's influencing their politics. But I thought it was worth using it as the screen to really try to get into some of this. And so you're an optimal guest. But why don't you just start by saying, like, why do you think podcasts have become so important for political campaigns while the legacy media is dwindling?
Yeah. Well, first, I'd just say I think that we are slouching towards dystopia, listening to what these people are consuming and how they're processing information. It's not great. So I just bear down, everybody. Why do I think that podcasts, et cetera, are having a greater influence? I think that there are a couple of things that are happening in play, and it's almost all related to our phones and how we consume stuff now. People are just so much more surrounded by information where they're getting, you know, little updates from their friends, what's happening today, little monologues from their friends into their phones, TikToks. Like the way that people are consuming information on their phones has made the kind of stilted traditional media just feel fake and inauthentic and not something that they connect with, right? And so podcasts are kind of a natural transition from that, where it's like, okay, I'm getting news, but it feels a little more natural. You know, you hear this in these focus groups all the time. I feel like I'm getting what people really think. You know, I'm getting a real view of the person, you know, in the interviews. And so I think like that is one reason, right? Like once you've started to see people more as they exist in nature rather than as they exist on the television screen, the more that you like want that, right? So I think that's one element of it. And I think that's mostly good, actually. The negative part of this is I think that because the internet gives you so much access to so much information all the time, it's like much easier to poke holes in the mainstream media and critique them. I'm stealing this from Matt Iglesias. I think it was from Matt, one of his articles I was reading. It was like, if it's 1987 and the Los Angeles Times writes a column and the headline of the column is like a little anti-Semitic or a little too biased towards the progressives or whatever, you enter anything, right? You get a couple letters to the editor from people that notice it. A lot of people don't even really notice it, don't even pay attention, right? And you just move on to the next newspaper the next day. Now it's like people get to cherry pick like the worst thing that any mainstream media outlet anywhere in the world does. And there is a whole cottage industry of people, including Joe Rogan and many of the people these focus groups consume, that like bring that up to be like, you can't trust them, you must trust me. Did you see this one headline in the Los Angeles Times? Like, these guys have gone woke. They're untrustworthy. Instead, you must stick with me. And it like has democratized media consumption in a way that's kind of bad, right? Because it emphasizes things that are more titillating, contrarian, you know, against the grain, right? And just the facts, ma'am, type straight news reporting doesn't compete as well in that democratized market. But I think that those two elements, like the authenticity element, and the fact that there's just so much information all at once that allows people to cherry pick and compete for attention in your algorithms, has kind of warped the way people consume information.
Yeah. So let me just hit a couple things you said, because I think they're actually really important and really true. But one is Tucker Carlson's really good at doing this, is to say, you cannot trust them. I am the only one who's going to tell you the real unvarnished truth. And it's funny because there are a lot of media companies, including Fox News, that started as an alternative to the mainstream media. And here's where you can trace this back to our days as young Republicans, where Republicans felt so shut out and ostracized from the mainstream media. You know, Jonah Goldberg would write columns for NRO, you know, conservatives in the mist, right? Whenever a Republican would win, there was sort of the mainstream media was of the left. And so there was a real like anthropological way of looking at Republicans. And at some point they said, you know what, we're going to go start our own media companies. And Fox News was right that there was a massive market and appetite for, at the time, was alternative media and is now very much like the largest cable network. So Tucker Carlson's there being like, they're all lying to you. We're the only ones who tell you the truth. And yet they themselves are part of the mainstream media. They have reporters at the White House. But even they then are not alternative enough, right? The podcasting world, and I think one of the reasons that podcasts now have dominated is that there are so many of them that popped up during COVID, including ours a little bit. We had started some of our podcasts, obviously, before, but during COVID, basically said everyone was like, mail me a microphone. I'm going to hook it up to my laptop, my desktop, and like, I'm a podcaster. I'm an influencer. And it created this Wild West open market that also, by the way, had value attached to it in the world. Like Joe Rogan got purchased by Spotify for $1 gajillion. So the sort of gold rush was on for anti-orthodox, like counter media. Okay. So that's one thing. And there's also a bunch of channels that popped up within there where people are like, ooh, I can get a big audience. I saw people, there were people I was following who realized that if they talked about trans stuff almost exclusively, they could get enormous followings.
Or anti-COVID counter information, ivermectin, whatever.
That's right. The thing that's interesting to me, though, is that I think there's a lot of conversation. You say the phones. One of the things about our phones is that it rewards like a short attention span and we consume like bite-sized information. But podcasts are long form. And one of the things you hear from people when they talk about why they like podcasts is they feel like they can have these parasocial relationships. So when you talk about it, it's more authentic. It's also weird. Like people are willing to hang out for hours with personalities that they like. And this goes to one of my core beliefs around what's happening in politics right now, which is how freaking lonely people are.
People are lonely.
People are just desperate for this connection. And the podcasts give them a world that they can hang out. And like, there was always some cable that did this just a little bit. Like Morning Joe always a little bit had their finger on the fact that people kind of wanted to hang out with the same group of people every morning in a looser kind of way. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons it was a successful cable show, but podcasts just took that on.
This is your Robert Putnam theory of it, right? It's like people are bowling alone. People don't have that third place to go hang out. Instead of replacing it with a healthy third place to go hang out, they are hanging out with podcast hosts, which is could be healthy if it's me and Sarah, but maybe a little less healthy than some other people. But yeah, I think that's right for sure.
All right. So let's listen to what folks thought about Rogan and the political landscape more broadly, how they talk about podcasts.
I kind of like the kind of people that Joe Rogan has on the show, like Elon Musk. It was kind of an interesting one to listen to. And some big people to get these big opinions out and open. And you know, it doesn't feel like I'm watching a newscast. And it just feels real. And I kind of like it that way.
The types of conversations that they have, like, make the guests and himself also seem more approachable. And I don't want to say relatable, but I don't know. It kind of makes him more normal almost, because let's say someone like Donald Trump, for example, who like is in the media a lot, and a lot of the media attention is negative or solely political content, it makes them like I guess overall just approachable. Like
a lot of informed guests who I feel like are not afraid to really, I don't know if represent is the best way to phrase it, but just like don't shy away from being honest and candid about how they feel. And I feel like that's great because it kind of helps me build trust overall podcast. And the Joe Rogan's going to get good guests on there, but also the fact that it helps me kind of like feel confident that what the information that I'm receiving from there is very, not only the information I should say, but also like the opinions that I'm receiving are very honest, I think is the best way to put it. So like Pod Save America, there's another one that I really like. Tucker Carlson's another guy that I really like. So it's just like a way for me to get like a variety of different opinions, a variety of different viewpoints. I feel like that's the best way to stay informed.
What I like about the interview is the fact that it's long and it doesn't feel scripted. It's more of a, like a free flow conversation of wherever it goes. I'm sure he has an idea of what type of questions he's going to ask, but it's still more of a free-flowing conversation. And some other podcasts I got into, Candace Owens. So she's usually like up to date on a lot of news. And I also kind of start realizing that I, in the past few years, I started leaning more conservative. And since kind of finding her, she's reflecting more of my views now, current views.
I feel like the success of Joe Rogan's podcast is because he's genuine. He actually wants to learn more about certain topics and certain ideas, and he allows his guests to speak freely without any type of agenda. It's not as scripted. It seems more real time. He's learning about this person's ideas and talking points, and he punches on that and asks questions in real time instead of having some type of scripted narrative or whatever to ask them. So that's what I enjoy about his podcast. As far as other podcasts that I do follow, I definitely follow Candace Owens' podcast. I think she's great. She's a great investigator. She speaks on a lot of topics that's, like other people mentioned, that's taboo in the legacy media. I also follow the Patrick Bet-David podcast. I follow some of Tucker Carlson and Piers Morgan.
I think his success is because he makes it a conversation. He does push back a little bit, but the way he pushes back isn't like combative. So we get to actually hear that person, whoever he's interviewing, we actually get to hear their point of view more so than if they went on a news station. If someone would go on a news station and get an interview, they're going to get a lot of pushback if they don't have the same ideas as that interviewer.
In the way it's formatted or how it's conversational, I think it really allows there to be some substance that you don't get with a lot of other interviews. The unscripted conversational aspects of it, you can really get to know who's on there and see their true feelings. They can't come in with rehearsed talking points necessarily and just stick to the scripts.
like, I know there's a lot of lying in interviews a lot too, but I'd say for the most part, he gets people to open up to him. So I really like that.
So let me zig on this for you, Tim.
Okay.
Which is to say, I actually hear a lot of good instincts and them saying what they like. Like, not only are they sitting through much longer form things as opposed to just getting sound bites, right? They're exploring longer form issues and digging into them. They like the civility of it, right? They like that people aren't having a shout fest and screaming at each other, which I think is a good instinct. And there's a guy in there who's like, I listen to Tucker and I listen to Pod Save America. Well, those two shows don't have similar messaging whatsoever.
Congrats, Vitor.
Yeah. And there was a guy who was voting for Harris, but always listened to Tucker because he wanted to get sort of this other viewpoint. And so people don't mind kind of marinating in a world that is not with their worldview. And I think that that is also healthy to try and explore these things. Then they want the authenticity, right? They want to know what the real person thinks. Like the Kamala Harris sitting down for a Dana Bash interview, you know, people don't really want that. They know it's scripted. They know it's kabuki theater. They know it's fake. And this is another thing about Donald Trump, right? Mainstream media, you hear people saying, well, he's a Nazi or he likes Nazis or praises Nazis. And then they hear him on Rogan for 3 hours and they think, well, that guy doesn't sound like a Nazi.
I want to take that point first.
Okay.
The Trump point, and then I'll talk to broader observations. Like, I had two thoughts in my mind at the same time after watching Trump on Rogan, right? The one was, and it's whatever, my brain is mush from consuming so much of this, so I forget what exactly was on Rogan, but, you know, there were two or three things he said that were insane, right? So, like, we pulled that out and talked about them, and I don't regret that. I think that's right. Like, you should talk about the two or three totally insane things that he said over the course of 3 hours and make sure that people know about that, that people didn't consume the Rogan interview. At the same time, though, I watched it and was like, I think the people watch this are going to be like, this guy seems fine.
Yeah.
Right? Because there are two or three things that seem insane. And then there are another two or three things that if you're super engaged like us or like really know the facts about something like the 2020 election, you know, you would be like, okay, this guy's full of shit and he's a liar. Right? But if you're not that steeped in all that information, they're like, oh, well, crazy Uncle Donald has a couple weird views here on a couple of things. But like on the rest of this stuff, it's like, this guy doesn't seem like a Nazi. I don't know Hitler in my mind, but Hitler must be much meaner than this. Like, would Hitler know this much about MMA fighters? And he's affable, right? Like, there's something that is de-radicalizing about just sitting in a session for 2.5 hours. And to me, I think that's why Kamala actually would have benefited from it. Not, I don't actually really care. I think that was the reason why she lost. But like, you know, this notion of, well, they'll pull out the worst thing. Yeah, that's true. But for the people that listen to it, it'll be like, wait, this person is not a Marxist, actually. Like this person
or
is not
trying,
right, or an idiot. So I think that that is a good lesson just for all politicians. Like, be less worried about the one clip that gets pulled out and for outlets with big audiences. Maybe it's not worth the risk for the one clip if you're talking to somebody with a tiny audience or a meaningless audience. Like, that was my big takeaway from the Trump part of it. The other thing on this building trust that I don't know how the legacy media fixes this or resolves this or deals with it, but it's their number one problem, right? The reason why Joe Rogan and us to a certain extent and others that do formats like this have built trust is because the people listen and they're not actually consuming Rogan through the little clips you see on your social media. Right. They're listening to all of the hours and they gain trust through all of those hours, right? And so put yourself in the shoes of if you're a big consumer of us, right? And you're consuming 10 hours of Bulwark a day, right? And then you see on your social media, some person's like, Tim was talking about how the Boston Marathon bomber was hot. Isn't he terrible, right? You've consumed 10 hours of Tim, of me. You know, now I'm speaking like Bob Dole, right? But like, you know that I was being tongue-in-cheek and being funny and that like I actually had a much more serious, like thoughtful take about all of this, right? Like,
right.
That is how the Rogan consumers are viewing those little clips that go around social media that make many of our listeners who don't consume any of Rogan think, well, that guy must be crazy. The only clips I ever see is when he sounds like an idiot or when he's talking about somewhere he has no idea what he's talking about. But the consumers of Rogan are consuming 10, 20 hours of him more a month. And so they're like, well, you know, everybody misses one every now and then, right? Yeah. So you get graded on this curve because you've built this trust with your audience because they know you, they've seen you correct yourself, they've seen you, you know, deal with complicated issues and work through them, and they've seen you change your mind and be transparent about it, right? So you build this trust with them. The mainstream media doesn't have that trust, though.
Right.
So when the mainstream media messes up one thing, people are like, oh, well, no, that's bias. That's fake. We can't trust them because they don't have the same relationship. I don't know how you fix that if you're the Times or CNN or whatever. to me, like, that explains like this tension. Why does Joe Rogan, who says conspiracy theories relatively regularly, have trust, but the New York Times doesn't? And it's because he's built trust through all of that time.
I'll also say that one of the things about being the media, I say with air quotes for people listening to the pod and not watching it, is that you pay for the sins of other people in the media. So maybe you screw up once, or like there's a screw up at the New York Times, but people are going to throw that in to a pile of sins from the LA Times and CNN. And so the distrust is with the media, meaning corporate media, legacy media, in a way where Javiel and I were doing the secret podcast today. And like, we didn't know if our facts were right. Like, we were bringing up actually who wrote something. We thought maybe it was Sam, Sam Stein. And we were like, but we don't know. And so people don't judge you by that. Like, we might be wrong. And we tell people the point of this podcast is so that we can work through ideas that we're not sure we're committed to.
Right.
And people appreciate that because they too sit and think about ideas and try to figure out how they feel about things. Now, people do this to us though. They pull clips of us and try to like hang us with them.
I mean, that just happened to me this week.
Yeah. My point is that we get grace where the mainstream media does not. What do you think that this portends for sort of legacy media, given the fragmentation that's taken place over the last few years?
It's bad. And the Times has kind of figured it out because they've just become so big, right? And their reporting is so authoritative across a huge range of issues that, you know, they're going to be able to survive people being mad about them about politics stuff, right? Or whatever. And they also have gained revenue through cooking and the games apps, right? Like, so the Times has figured this out in a way to be sustainable. The Wall Street Journal has figured out a way to be sustainable on CNBC because they have a niche where that people trust their expertise, still business stuff. And so if their other reporting loses credibility, that's fine. They're still going to have their business verticals, right? So some TV outlets going to figure out how to do the Times thing, right? Where they have other ways where they're bringing in revenue. The local media part, I don't know how to fix. Like, that part is, I think, very challenging. One idea I have, just while we're throwing around no bad ideas in a brainstorm, I was talking to a nonprofit group that supports local media outlets. And I was like, you know who I have trust with in local media? My sports teams podcasts, right? Because it's the same thing as Rogan, kind of like after the game, I want to see what three people that I like thought about the game. And I'm like, maybe you can get revenue that way by creating podcasts about community things, sports, weather, events, cultural things that are happening in the city, and use that to kind of subsidize the other stuff. But I don't know. The legacy outlets, if they don't have expertise like the Journal does in a specific vertical, are going to have to figure out how to compete on trust and doing so in some of these more informal environments. And that's kind of hard to do on like hard news, but maybe they can do it in adjacent, you know, kind of spaces to support the hard news.
Yeah. So one of the things that I talk about a lot when I talk about communications philosophies and who people trust, you just use the word trust. And I think trust is sort of an essential piece of this conversation and how low trust voters are. Like, one of the things that's happening is people talk about loss of faith in institutions. That is really, really real. It's true of the media. It's true of the government. It's true of healthcare. Like, it's true of like almost most verticals, maybe not sports, although I don't know enough about sports to say. Like, whether cynicism, you know, is coming and eating that too. But people trust people like me, not me, Sarah Longwell, but people like them, which again, I think speaks to why there is more trust in the podcast format, because people feel like they are in, and we get this all the time. People are like, I feel like you're my friend. I feel like I know you. But I meet people who are fans of ours and I'm like, start talking to them like a human. And I'm like, oh, do you have kids? I got two boys. You know, they'll be like, yeah, I know. You know, I listen to you all the time, right? They know you in a real way. So people trust these personalities, which is another thing I think the media is struggling with, is that they are institutions. They are a collection of many talented people. And some of those people have personalities. Those personalities often live on editorial pages, which oftentimes can be out of sync, like in the Wall Street Journal's case with their actual reporting, where the reporting is very sober and good and filled with expertise, and the editorial page is filled with nonsense. But like, listening to these groups and how little they trust everything. So one of the things that obviously was in the news, what are you thinking about this week? And one of the things was we asked people about Trump's confirmation stuff. And so we were asking about Pete Hegseth. Nobody had heard of Pete Hegseth. Like, they're hopeful that Donald Trump's going to make good choices and they're praying about it and they're, you know, whatever, but they are not following it. You know what they're following? They're following the United Healthcare CEO. Everybody had heard about that. nobody knew about Pete Hegseth. There was like one Marco guy who was like happy with Marco, but like the rest of it, they just like weren't tracking that hard. So we conducted these couple of groups that you're hearing sound from right after the murder of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, including one after the shooter was taken into custody. So while this might not seem like the usual topic for this show, we were curious about their reactions, like through the lens of this preferred media diet. So let's listen to how they thought about the news coverage of the shooting and subsequent manhunt.
I am wondering how within a week they were able, supposedly found the guy, but President Trump-elect had pretty much two attempts, and we still don't really know a lot about the first shooter. That just blows my mind. And it also makes me question, since there is so much publicity about this recent shooting, is there something else going on that everyone is paying attention to this shooting so people don't pay attention to something else?
I feel like this is a distraction or some type of psyop in the news cycle where everything seems fishy. It doesn't seem like everything, the logistics of how he got caught, what he was caught with, the gun, the manifesto. All this stuff is like, I'm reading about it. I'm looking into it. It doesn't seem as real as it should be. I'm questioning the authenticity of who this individual they've caught. Is it the right one? These type of things are going through my head. But I'm also, you know, I find it silly that they're trying to make this guy a martyr for activism, for revisiting the healthcare system. I feel like it doesn't solve anything at all.
I'm not really surprised by the reaction or how much coverage it's getting, just because it's high profile violence, a high profile figure in the heart of Manhattan. And it brings out a lot of rightful anger about the American healthcare system. So to me, it makes perfect sense. And it's going to draw eyes and ratings and clicks and everything. So I think we're going to continue to see coverage of it, unfortunately.
So this was the group that we talked to after he'd been caught, but we talked to the other group about this as well. And there was a ton of personal angst. Like, they all talked about dealing with the healthcare industry bureaucracy and how unhappy they were with the industry. Although I would say there was nobody in these groups that were like celebrating this guy getting shot, which
but
it goes to the anonymity of online and the way that people feel much more emboldened online to use their like most heartless take in a way that in a group of people where like your name was there and you're talking to somebody, people did not really behave that way.
Yeah.
There was like a, I can see why people are this mad and like did this. So when I was a teenager, it was before you had iPads or laptops, but I had like a Trapper Keeper thing that had a sticker on it that said, question everything. I had another one, I think it's on my bunk bed, that said, question authority, right? Because I was a really edgy teen. but I just, every time I listen to folks in these focus groups, I think they're just like all manifesting the bumper stickers of a 17-year-old, right? But like the extent to which people now are primed to question everything. Like, oh, this is getting so much news coverage. It might be a psyop. I hear this stuff all the time. This isn't just some fringy thing. This is how a lot of people are thinking nowadays.
Yeah, it's a complex world that people are looking for stuff to grab onto. So I get it. But, you know, the psyop element of this, that clip segment could have gone on for 15 minutes. People that weren't really sure that it was Luigi, but there were still a couple people like that. They're focused on the unibrow. One guy was in the picture that didn't match his eyebrows at the McDonald's. And the views weren't coherent, which I think is important. Jon Favreau wrote something in The Atlantic this week that's very good. People should go read about how a lot of high info people, you can kind of fit us in a box of some kind. You know, you're like, oh, that's a person that's kind of a Bernie-ish progressive or a Warren-ish progressive. And this is kind of a moderate, never Trumper type. Or, you know, this is an establishment Democrat. These groups, like the views were totally not coherent at all within each individual and certainly across the groups, right? Like the idea that it was like, oh, they were all people that were really mad at the healthcare system. Nope, there were some that were. There were a couple of people that worked in the healthcare system that were worried about their own safety. That one guy that was like, this feels like a psyop, but also I don't think we should glorify him. Their views are not formulated. The one thing that ties them all together is your point, this kind of rebellious, contrarian, like, I just don't trust, I don't believe anything is true. And I think that was, to me, the more interesting takeaway. The Rogan appeal to like the high-low voter was also interesting because like the groups had like 2/3 of people were these kind of low info, you know, like the PSYOP guy, like exactly what you would expect to hear from a Rogan voter. I don't mean that as pejorative. I just mean like,
and you know, we shouldn't say that they're not consuming information. They just don't consume tons of political information. Like right. That guy was going deep on the healthcare stuff.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. And so their archetype is different than the crypto investing, college educated white guys, you know, that were very well versed on the Trump nominees and what was happening in the news. And, you know, we're probably Mitt Romney voters, but have gotten sucked into some of this contrarianism stuff, particularly around RFK vaccines, particularly around crypto.
You know, JVL and I had this argument on the Seeker Pod about COVID and its lasting implications and or impacts on the American psyche. And to me, it was pretty clear from these groups that there was a major inflection point in recent years that had brought out some of the like deep skepticism they had, and that was around COVID. People who had been questioning COVID all along, like Joe Rogan or others, they questioned the vaccine, but they also questioned the efficacy of masks. JBL got really mad when I said this, as his wife. He was like, what are you talking about? A million people died. But like, I remember putting on my 3-year-old one of these cloth masks. They had to wear them at school. And we'd have to give him lots of them because he would drool. They'd get wet. He'd get chapped face. We were constantly always putting like Vaseline on his face. And like, I hated the period of masking. And you do it. And then you find out later that the cloth masks were useless. It was like a kabuki theater we were all engaged in.
The cloth masks.
Like. No, I mean the cloth masks. I'm not saying all that. No, the N95s, but you remember there was a really long time. I remember it because of my kids and how I had to put them on them. But like we were all wearing cloth masks for a really long time before we started with the K95s.
I know. No, trust me. I'm with you. I had also a preschooler. She was in a French bilingual preschool. And I was like, this is pointless. Literally, she'd be learning more if I put her in front of Sesame Street 8 hours a day than having a teacher speaking a different language in a mask. While she's wearing a mask, it was ridiculous.
We're still dealing with learning issues that have to do with, you know, like speech. And so to find out later that the cloth masks were really, they kind of told us that because there weren't enough K95s to go around. And until we had produced enough, like that made a lot of people angry. JBL's point, and I'm sympathetic to this too, is like once in a lifetime pandemic, everybody's trying to rope their way through and, you know, people are doing their best. And I agree with that. But it's frustrating to act like it had no consequences. So let's play the COVID mistrust sound and how COVID affected things for the Rogan crowd and these Biden to Trump groups.
One particular figure that I feel like should be prosecuted or investigated is Dr. Fauci. Just constant lies with these band-aids and saying the statistics of how many people got killed, what it was been reported, what news was supposed to report, and then the cancellation of people who bring up questions regarding this. They try to cancel Joe Rogan, a lot of other different people. That's why a lot of people have woken up from that and realized that the information we see on TV or it's providing us is totally unreliable. So I think it's like a lot of the power transferred over to X, Elon. There's a lot of censorship going around during the pandemic. You can't question the vaccine. You're ostracized if you're to say anything about it. People will label you a conspiracy theorist, loony, tuned person. Like everything's coming to the light where the whole pandemic was just basically a lie. Like it was like a flu where you could, the survival rate is like 90% or something like that.
So I was working in the hospital. I was working the testing tents to test for COVID. We're kind of one of the first to try to like learn how to test for people, you know. But as far as like we had doctors that were like, why are we just doing these masks like this? Like the only ones that are actually that help are like the N95. Like, why are we masking? You know, of course, if you're like you have a cold and you're just like coughing over the place, prevent splatter, but these masks on these kids that are in their mouth being shared, it's ridiculous. Like, why are these kids having to wear these masks in school or having to be forced to do homeschooling at home? But for me in the hospital, I was going to lose my job if I didn't get 2 of the COVID vaccines. I felt like I was forced to get these shots or I was going to lose my job, which I felt is really ridiculous on my part, where I felt, well, I'm not ready to get this only option that came into the hospital, you know, the certain brand. And now they like, well, we're not doing that one anymore. It causes blood clots.
I mean, the last four 4 years, especially before Elon bought X. I mean, the censorship and the disinformation label was really out of hand, in my opinion. You couldn't question anything without getting deplatformed or questioned as a conspiracy theorist. So I think stuff he did by simply just questioning vaccines and COVID and ivermectin, that kind of stuff, I thought that was really important. Be able to have conversations again. You couldn't question anything. People were getting censored, kicked off social media, you know, labeled conspiracy theorists. I mean, it's come out now that the whole 6 feet thing was just made up. I mean, statistics constantly getting altered. The efficacy of masks that's been shown have been made up. I mean, you could just go back and look at everything, the damage it's done, did to children who were forced to homeschool. I mean, you had people masking kids when there was no need for that.
Okay, so before I get Tim's reaction, which looks like it'll be intense, I do want to do a quick peek behind the curtain because we've had an issue with a few recent focus groups because YouTube has flagged what they consider medical misinformation to be contained in them, in the sound that we post. So for YouTube system, I am not endorsing these people's opinions. I am merely presenting them as opinion research information. The opinions of focus group participants do not necessarily reflect objective truth or the editorial position of the Bulwark. And I have to say that because we couldn't send the clips to each other on YouTube like we normally do because they took them down for medical misinformation, which I do think validates just slightly what some of these people are saying.
Yeah, sure. I don't like people being deplatformed or whatever. I don't think it's necessary. I just like the intensity of their views on this and like the idea that Joe Rogan is being canceled and Elon is being canceled. And like they're the two most influential people in the world, I think. They're doing great. So like this whole thing just frustrates me, the notion that people are really being silenced. Look, here's my constructive thought. There's something about human nature and the nature of human trust where that makes it much more appealing to be anti the establishment, anti elite, to be giving it to the man. Like there are people that score high on agreeableness if you take those Myers-Briggs tests or whatever, but like there is a big majority of society, and it might be a uniquely American element to this too, yeah, where people like to feel like they're independent, you know? And the Democrats used to have this, right? Like the Democrats were anti-war, anti-corporate.
Democrats used to have Joe Rogan.
Yeah. And as the parties have sorted among like where all the low trust people on one side, all the high trust people on the other side,
yeah,
the Democrats have lost their ability to do that. And I think that's a real problem for them and something that they're going to have to think about going forward, how to remedy. Because I just listened to all this and on the COVID thing. And I basically agree with all of these people's critiques. Like I was much closer to Jared Polis or to like some of the Republican governors on COVID than I was to my state governor at the time, Gavin Newsom. I still have my libertarian 17-year-old trapper keeper question everything streak somewhere inside of me. But I also have grown up and have gotten a lot more information and I have a lot more respect for people who have to do challenging things. And I look at this situation and I'm like, well, the government had some big foul-ups, but the experts were also the ones that created the damn vaccine that got us out of this thing, you know? And so like there was an old kind of Republican appreciation for the entrepreneur side that would have been like, hell yeah, America, these scientists and these experts, and we did Operation Warp Speed. We created this vaccine. That was kind of like the Republican instinct that I was drawn to, but that always lived in pairing with the tear down the government sucks. And the first part is gone, and now it's all anti-elite, anti-establishment. And it's very frustrating to me because it's like Fauci is held accountable for all of his mistakes, of which there are definitely some. But like these guys, the contrarian COVID people, they had some of the worst predictions out there. A lot of these guys were like, I think that there's only going to be between 5 and 20,000 deaths worldwide. You know, and it's like, you couldn't have been more wrong than they were on some of this stuff. But the people that have positioned themselves as the contrarians and as the anti-establishment people, they didn't have to carry the baggage of any of their mistakes. Because all they were charged with doing was poking holes at the people that were actually doing stuff.
Right.
And that makes their life a lot easier. And that's frustrating. And that pisses me off.
It's also frustrating that a great many of the mistakes that were made with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Like Donald Trump, he was constantly injecting, to use a term, stupid information into the ecosystem. He also lied to people about...
Downplayed it at the beginning.
Yeah, and he knew better, and it came out later in Woodward's book that he had information about how bad it was telling people it would be fine. You know, we got this op-ed by Mike Pence, there'll be no COVID second wave. Like, yeah, they were all wrong too. And here's the thing. None of us knew what was going on. None of us knew anything about this. Everybody was kind of wrong. And like, we were a country trying to do our best in the moment. And I think there's a lot of things that we can look back and say, you know what? Once we figured out where the risk was really stratified, which is that the risk was very low for children and was really for people with pre-existing conditions and who were older, get kids back to school. And teachers' unions put up a big fight over that, and Democrats capitulated. And like, that is annoying to me, and it's annoying for reasons that are like, why are we listening to...
Yeah, and here's one more thing on this that I actually don't understand. I just want to put this out there because I understand the appeal of the contrarian, of the anti-establishment. I understand the people who are annoyed by the COVID rules and are frustrated and want to lash out. The thing I don't get, though, is just one example that comes to mind, but there's so many. In my husband's county in West Virginia, there was all of this anti-vax misinformation out there. And I went back, I think it was for a funeral, not COVID-related. And all the talk was about the football coach who was in his 40s and had a bunch of kids, hadn't gotten the vaccine and had died of COVID. At the time, it was during COVID. So, you know, I was interested. I was like, what's happening in the community? Are they anti-vax? Is there all this anti-Fauci stuff? And like the consensus in this moment was like, I don't know, people are kind of dialing it back a little bit because this guy died and it's been a shockwave through the community. And yet that stuff didn't stick. And like, I really just don't understand why.
A million people dying wasn't enough for people to be like, but also it was really bad, guys.
Yeah, right. I'm also still annoyed. Kind of just hearing you talk about your three-year-old having to mask makes me a little bit annoyed inside my body. So I understand why people are still annoyed about three-year-olds having to mask. At the same time, I don't understand why that annoyance has managed to persist while people orphaning their children because they were fed misinformation by assholes who had a political agenda. Well, that hasn't stuck. That's one that flummoxes me.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can solve the nonlinear way these things.
That paradox. Yeah, you can't solve that paradox for me.
All right, that's it. No more shouting into the void, because the void isn't listening. In this post-election moment, there is a subreddit, a meme page, or newsletter for every one of your opinion bubbles. But if you want to stay involved with political news by understanding why the other side feels the way they do, you need Left, Right, and Center. It's a weekly roundtable with representatives from both sides of the aisle, because you want to understand, not just hear someone agree with you. I'm David Green, hosting Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
All right. So I want to get to some more sound. I do want to talk about asking these voters about the nominees. But from here on out, these are not exclusively the Rogan listeners. Okay. They're still first-time Trump voters, meaning they voted for Biden previously. So obviously the allegations against Pete Hegseth for alcohol abuse and sexual assault have been in the news, even though many of the Joe Rogan listeners had not been following it, but some of the other groups had. So let's listen to what they said about Pete Hegseth.
I did watch an interview with him and a little more details on the smear, on the alcohol issues, on what his mother said, who subsequently apologized for the email. And I think it's just not even good look, like breaking into his emails, trying to get that information. For me, it's not a really effective way of putting somebody in a bad light anymore. So given how information was obtained, it doesn't really affect the way how I feel about his credibility. Again, I don't know him too much. Hopefully he will get approved and we'll see what comes out of it. But the negative news does not really affect how I feel about him one way or the other.
I could touch on a little more broad since, because I'm actually not familiar with him. But overall, when it comes to like allegations like that, whether they're true or not, and this may sound a little insensitive, but I guess no, I'm not too concerned about it. To me, it doesn't really matter what kind of allegations you have in your personal life. I'm more concerned about like, what are your political views? And that's why, like, to me, I'm typically indifferent about allegations like that?
TBD. It's so hard because, you know, there's so much rhetoric out there, you know, and there's so much character assassination because there is people who have agendas, you know, and don't want certain things to go a certain way. So I think, you know, it's pretty overwhelming to try to keep track of all this. It is for me anyway. It's just, you know, it's a ton of stuff. And I am, to a certain degree, just placing some trust in the new administration that the right thing is going to be done. Yeah, there'll be mistakes. There might be some oversights and what have you. But, you know, I got to think at the end of the day that they're going to do the right thing.
Is he the one that there was some controversy? It was something that I actually just saw like yesterday where mm-hmm. he was in his swim trunks. And I might be thinking of the wrong person at the 9/11 monument.
She does have the right person because Hegseth appeared in his swim trunks at the 9/11 memorial because he was doing a charity swim across the Hudson River. We, you and I, and the mainstream media are paying a great deal of attention to Trump's picks and their lack of qualifications. This is what voters do, though. They voted for Trump, and they're like, I don't know who this guy is, but I'm tapping out now. Like, Trump's going to pick who he's going to pick, and I hope they're good, and I'm going to give him a chance. And also, this skepticism that comes from somebody on their side, and by their side, I don't even mean like Republicans in this case, but like, they voted for Trump, he's Trump's picks, and so there really is this, like, I don't know, you know, the media goes after everybody and they say everybody's controversial. And like in the post-Me Too world, the extent to which voters are just primed for a bunch of controversy and like don't care about it is kind of startling.
Yeah, that part is startling. And I don't know that I have much more to add other than it's a little dispiriting. I will say this, to your point about how like a lot of people are like, yeah, I want to see how it goes. It supports one of my theses, which is of all the autopsy stuff of the Democratic Party, like Trump failing would really be the best elixir for the Democrats. Cause like there are a bunch of people in here that are just kind of like, yeah, if he gets us into a stupid war and things go bad, I'll be like, okay, I'll throw him out and we'll try somebody else new. And I'll want some anti-establishment Democrat next time, probably. To me, like that's the interesting thing about listening to these groups. I know some of these weren't Rogan people, but even just broadening it out to the new Trump voter group altogether, they're kind of like, are these categories of people? There are three that I want to highlight. There's like the totally red pilled. I'm watching Candace Owens and Patrick Bet-David and Joe Rogan and like the Tucker, and that's my world now. And I love that Kash Patel is in there, and I hope that he's going to go after his foes. Like there were a handful of those people.
Yeah, we're going to play the retribution show.
Okay, great. So we'll get to that next. Then there was the group that's like, I'm not really paying that much attention. Things aren't going that great. You know, I don't trust anybody. I don't trust these elites, and we're taking a flyer on Trump, right? Like yeah. That was the low info kind of casual. And then you had like the very familiar to you and me, like traditional Republican type guys that like didn't like Trump's personality, but have been sucked back in via some combination of like COVID and crypto and
hating Democrats.
Hating Democrats, yeah. Right? And so to me, A, there's something to be learned there from Democrats about like who of those groups are gettable. Obviously the lowest info group. So like how do you communicate to them? And that takes me to this communication question, which is kind of like, I think the subtext of doing a Joe Rogan focus group, which is this whole convo about like the Dems need their own Rogan. And like, to me, the secret sauce there of that audience is that he has the high info and the low info, right? He's doing both. And like, there were some people that were listening. They're like, oh yeah, I tune in when it's this kind of thing, but I don't tune in when it's that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And like, that's something that's missing, right? Like doing a just straight, I'm a liberal, question everything, straight talking, progressive, that just talks about how the Republicans are corrupt and terrible. Like that's got a ceiling on it. The people that are getting drawn into this net are like some super politically obsessed people. And then a bunch of people who kind of like just like hearing interesting conversations about unexpected things. And then they're getting tangentially having some pretty Trumpy politics really injected into their feeds. And like that, to me, is the media challenge for Democrats, like replicating that model, you know, not like the, oh, we need more progressive, Trump sucks media.
This is exactly right. This is why it's so important that Democrats figure out how to go everywhere, because I can't remember which of my podcasts I really focused on this, but like, if you think about the different verticals that there are on social media where people are really invested in something that isn't politics. So wellness, for example, is a massive vertical on social media. And RFK has a toehold within that wellness community. It's some of the anti-vax stuff, but it's also about like what you eat and like the colors that are in processed things. Seed oils, right. And so fitness, huge vertical.
Ghee.
Also, ghee?
Ghee is very important. G-H-E-E.
Oh, is that a, that's a
tallow,
supplement
tallow.
Or something?
Yeah, I don't know. What the fuck do I know? You think I do ghee?
I don't know. But like fitness and being a man is like a whole vertical.
And so
there's all of these places where Republicans are going into those spaces to figure out how they inject a little bit into those audiences. Those people are not there fundamentally for politics, but their politics gets informed by these other things that they're much more passionate about. Low info political types who catch their politics by osmosis. They don't watch the news, but it comes in through these other verticals. You know, Kellyanne Conway and I, when we were at this thing, and she was just like kept yelling in my ear while I was trying to make a point. One of the things I was saying is like, yes, people believe these things because you lie to them and tell them false things. But then they're like trying to hide behind the voters. You know, they're like, well, Americans believe X, as though they played no role in getting Americans to believe X, right? Like the election was stolen. But they are much better at working the media channels. And I mean media in the biggest, broadest sense of all the things that people are consuming, in a way that Democrats still use this old, tired playbook of, well, we're going to go on CNN. This isn't against CNN. It's just more like, we're going to do very conventional things.
Sure,
to a dwindling audience of people who basically consume politics as their dominant vertical, which is different.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So you brought up Kash Patel, and I want to get to this. So when we asked about Kash Patel as the nominee for FBI director and the possibility of investigating or prosecuting Trump's political opponents, we heard a lot of these first-time Trump voters struggle with that a bit. Let's listen, starting with one woman talking about Patel's FBI investigating Trump's opponents.
I think if he does, good for him, because they've been doing that on the Democratic side for everybody else that is more of a Trump supporter. So tit for tat, I guess.
My gut is yes, like investigate them. But I think we've gotten into now a dangerous precedent where we're using the legal system to go after political opponents. And I think we need to move away from that. Not saying they shouldn't be held to the same justice system that all of us are. But I think a lot of times now we fall into the trap where we're going after people just because they're a political candidate for a different party. And I think it's dangerous to keep doing that.
You don't want this to turn into like a vendetta, right? Personal vendetta and revenge and that sort of thing. But if there is an injustice that's taking place and our institutions, you know, that we rely on to protect us and to uphold justice, if there's corruption on that end, that needs to be found out. That needs to be routed out. That can't go on. That's a big part of the problem that we're facing, is corruption on a systemic level in so many ways.
So far, with the information that I could gather about Kash being the FBI nominee, I'm excited to see what's coming. Because I think there's a lot of information that needs to come out. And just in general, having like that fourth branch of government, I think it's kind of been going the wrong way for a long time. And the fact that it doesn't feel like the government really serving people, but a lot of secrets being kept away from people for their own protection, I think it's kind of getting too much and people are getting tired of it.
I don't think that it's going to be politicized and he's going to go after people that need to be prosecuted. And I feel like he has the credentials and just the wherewithal to actually approach certain situations without being hesitant. I think that he has a serious demeanor that we need for that specific position. So
I'm a big fan. I feel like he's not some lifetime bureaucrat and that he's going to get in there and kind of make the FBI about what it should be. And it's not going to be politicized anymore. Yeah, that he's not going to be afraid to prosecute who needs to be prosecuted. I guess my main thing is I don't think it's going to be politicized anymore. And that's exciting for me. I'm a little torn on it. Maybe I should have said it shouldn't be weaponized rather than politicized. I'm a little torn on it. I think Trump had a good comment the other day about he wasn't going to go after Biden because he wants to look forward, not in the past. However, the other side of that is maybe they need to be investigated so this kind of stuff never happens again. So set a precedent so it can't happen again.
Okay, so the last part of that last guy's answer was where we asked him about Patel doing things like prosecuting Liz Cheney, and he was struggling around with that idea a little bit.
That guy gave the most interesting exchange. They're doing this thing at once, and it's working, I guess, with this audience, which is like, the deep state has been really politicized against Mr. Trump. The deep state's coming for Mr. Trump. We must stop that. We must clean it up. These are bad people that are all going after him. And the Justice Department has never been politicized like this. And so you share that in some of the answers. People are like, oh, okay, well, great. A new guy, an outsider, it's not going to politicize. And then when the question is, well, should they go after their enemies? It's like, well, I don't know, maybe. Maybe a little politicization is good. Yeah, it's like, yeah, maybe. Oh, it does seem bad. Ooh, I'm kind of torn on that. But yeah, I don't know. I guess let me downgrade. Maybe politicization is fine, but maybe not weaponization.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for my friends, everything, for my enemies, the law is definitely sinking in with the voter base there.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you if you think that in the coming years, you could activate these voters' skepticism of man, right? When Trump oversteps his bounds, right? When they do go after people, are people going to revolt and say, hey, no, 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 we said we didn't want this? Or do most of these voters simply view Trump as the good guy and the more establishment opponents as the bad guy?
I think the latter. I think, yes, some of these people are able to be activated when Trump oversteps in ways that are tangible that they can see and feel. Say what you want about COVID, like long tail ended up helping Trump, but it hurt him in 2020, short term, right? Because people didn't like what he was doing. I'm sad to say if Kash Patel starts investigating Liz Cheney, I don't think that there's going to be a principled backlash among the people in these groups. I'm not seeing that coming.
Yeah, I think in the red-pilled groups, there's not. I think the question remains whether sort of more institutional Republicans say, no, I see why we cannot live like this and try to like end the tit for tat, as that woman called it.
I like your naive optimism there. I'm not seeing it.
Don't call it naive.
I'm seeing it in other spaces.
I'm suggesting it's possible.
Yeah, I'm not really seeing it in the Justice Department, but we'll see. I'd love to be wrong. I've been wrong before. Who knows?
All right, Tim Miller, sometimes wrong, not always. Tim Miller, thanks so much for coming on, and thanks to all of you for listening to the Focus Group podcast. We're not going anywhere, guys. We'll be back sometime around the inauguration time for season 5.
This is it, though? This is the end of season 4?
Oh, you're our closer. I'm the capstone. You're our closer.
Guys, I have to tell you, it's a beautiful podcast. And just the fact that Sarah does this for you every week, I mean, I just hope you appreciate it because it is unbearable to listen to these focus groups. So thank you to Sarah and to all of the listeners for, you know, I don't know, this sort of nutritious podcast material.
All right. Thanks, Tim. In the meantime, be sure to rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Bulwark on YouTube and become a Bulwark Plus member at thebulwark.com. Guys, we're making great stocking stuffer. Go give the gift of sanity and The Bulwark to all your friends and family members. And have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will see you in 2025.